on their bodies and dedicate their deaths to the death of others. Free societies inspire young men and women to work and achieve and dedicate their lives to the life of their country. And in the long run, I have great faith that the appeal of freedom and life is stronger than the lure of hatred and death. Freedom's advance in the Middle East will have another very practical effect. The terrorist movement feeds on the appearance of inevitability. It claims to rise on the currents of history, using past American withdrawal.
Shut the hell up, Boy George. This rhetoric about the terrorist movement feeds on the appearance of inevitability. Okay, well, so that's why you terrorists say market globalization and outsourcing of jobs is inevitable. Now it's real clear. And then you babble out. I have great faith that the appeal of freedom and life have strong appeal over hatred and death. Well, actually, so do I. That's why, as a revolutionary, I know this raggedy government in the U.S. of A. is going to get overthrown. And then you yap. Free societies don't inspire its young men to strap bombs to their bodies. No imperialist societies like this inspire young men and women to strap themselves into jet airplanes so that they can drop bombs on defenseless third world people. That's what this society does. Shut the hell up. You know what time it is. Slave time. Listening to 104.1, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 106.7 Illinois, LUBER.com, the world, slave revolt time. Tonight we're going to shoot our way into a Beyond the Shadow segment, as it's going to deal with the issues of denial in America and how that is devouring the core in many ways of the psychic and confidence of this population. But we'll start it off with a war cry segment that deals with that same theme and mythology on its so-called greatest generation. So we got all that and hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt.
As the train taking us into Fort Knox chugged through the hills of Kentucky into this fort, orders came down in the train for us to pull our shades down. We were riding in a segregated train where the blacks rode in the front right behind the chugging locomotive, and in a car one and car two, where we got all the fumes and noise and everything else from this thing. Orders came down for us to pull the shades down. And the guys, we were in the first two cars, pulled the shades down. I didn't realize what this was all about. I made inquiries. I got no answers. I got out between the two cars, number one and number two car, to see why we had to pull the shades down. Just my curiosity as a 16-year-old. We were going right through old hee-haw country. We saw some of these old cowboys and some of these old mountaineers waving at the train, the troop train, with their rifles. Later on, I found out they told us to pull it down for our own protection because they'd fired on these all-black cars several times in the past. Well, anyway, I took my basic training in Fort Knox, Kentucky, and then they really sent me back behind the Cotton Curtain. Russia has an Iron Curtain. America has a Cotton Curtain.
Well, these things travel slowly and move slowly. When you're talking about the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award, it took time to establish the case. And the case that also had to be established was, can it be demonstrated that it was racial prejudice that kept them from getting the award at that time?
On government orders, I couldn't go to a dining car and be fed. Well, I got down there, and you're talking about filth and whatnot. We were stationed in the worst part of this camp in Louisiana, next to a sewage disposal pit where there was filth all over. We had tar paper huts that we lived in. If we got a package from home, usually people from home would send goodies that we enjoyed eating and whatnot. It laid into the orderly room until mail call later on in the evening. Then it was infested with roaches from the sewers and all like that.
Well, these things travel slowly and move slowly. When you're talking about the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award, it took time to establish the case. And the case that also had to be established was, can it be demonstrated that it was racial prejudice that kept them from getting the award at that time?
This was just the black units. What a disappointment I felt going into this man's army and being mistreated like this, not being able to ride in any section of the train, not being able to ride in any part of the bus or trolley car or whatever. My people were from the Caribbean. They didn't know anything about segregation. I told them about this in letters that I wrote home. They couldn't understand. So I was so determined to let these people know what it was all about that I removed a white-colored sign from a streetcar in Alexandria, Louisiana, which I still have today. As we served in Camp Hood, Texas, it's now Fort Hood, Texas, the Italian and German prisoners of war had more liberties on the post than we did. We were confined to the black area only. The German or the Italian prisoners could roam the whole damn post without guards. They could go into any PX on the post. Here recently in 1991, when I went to Europe for doing a documentary, one of these German soldiers approached as the Channel 13 WNET was filming, and this German approached and wanted to know what we were all about. When he found out that we were black soldiers serving in the discriminating army in the U.S., he says, "I was a prisoner of war. I was in Tennessee. I had more rights than you people." You talking about being angered, but I had to keep my cool.
Well, these things travel slowly and move slowly. When you're talking about the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award, it took time to establish the case. And the case that also had to be established was, can it be demonstrated that it was racial prejudice that kept them from getting the award at that time?
The 761st Tank Battalion were the original Black Panthers, unlike the Panthers of the 60s who said, "Hell no, I won't go." The majority of us were volunteers. Our unit fought for 183 consecutive days in the European theater of operation. Four major campaign ribbons we received. Now, up until the Spanish-American War, 31 black soldiers and 5 black seamen received the Congressional Medal of Honor. World War I and World War II, not one black serviceman received this until April 5th of 1991, when George Bush awarded the nation's highest award to a Freddie Stoa killed some 70 years prior to in World War I. World War II till this date. Not one has received it.
Well, these things travel slowly and move slowly. When you're talking about the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award, it took time to establish the case. And the case that also had to be established was, can it be demonstrated that it was racial prejudice that kept them from getting the award at that time?
It was over a million Afro-Americans served in World War II. There were 455, I believe, 455 Congressional Medals of Honor awarded, but none ever to any blacks. You know, I'm very outspoken about this because it was so disappointing to me as a young volunteer going into something like this. Washington, D.C., may I say, was a point of segregation. Traveling from New York back to Camp Hood, Texas, I could travel any part of a train till I reached Washington, D.C. When I hit Union Station, we were the conductors or the whoever on the train came through and announced that all blacks would have to go to the first two cars in the forward part of the train. See? That's why I say up until today, my country tis of thee, O sweet land of bigotry.
Well, these things travel slowly and move slowly. When you're talking about the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award, it took time to establish the case. And the case that also had to be established was, can it be demonstrated that it was racial prejudice that kept them from getting the award at that time?
During our fighting in Europe, as I stated, my unit fought for 183 consecutive days through six European countries. The average lifespan of a tank battalion in combat at the time was 8 to 12 days. We never had a Red Cross coffee donut truck come up to us. I used to see them come up and serve the white troops, but not to us. See? We never had that opportunity, see? Never once did I have a shower truck. I'd like to say also, D.J. Williams, a company commander in this unit, he was loved by all the troops. This man had compassion. This man didn't have this bitterness and this staunch bigotry and all like that in him. He has fought for 53 years to get this honor to Reuben Rivers. 53 years. His monies and every damn thing else. He finally got a university convinced to do a study on blacks why they didn't receive this high award. See? I have to give it to him. He was a fighter. And here we are, waiting to see this award. Some of my comrades killed in combat. The parents wouldn't even send for their bodies. No.
Well, these things travel slowly and move slowly. When you're talking about the Medal of Honor, the nation's highest award, it took time to establish the case. And the case that also had to be established was, can it be demonstrated that it was racial prejudice that kept them from getting the award at that time?
There was racism in the 40s. The Pentagon admits that. But racism today, I can't prove that. After all, Colin Powell was chief of staff. They had black generals. But I have my opinion, which I probably shouldn't voice. I smelled racism.
Did Colin Powell help?
I don't want to comment on that.
And I hope what the people of America will see over the next couple of days as Lieutenant Baker and his deceased colleagues are recognized is a man who represents many, many men who served with quiet dignity, who served a country that was not serving them, but nevertheless served. And I hope it will give inspiration to new generations of youngsters coming up, black and white, of what valor and service to country mean. Of what valor and service to country mean. Of what valor and service to country mean.
It's come to my understanding that even though the Veterans Administration is trying to deny that you guys are really as sick as you appear to be, several hospitals, like one in Santa Cruz, for instance, no longer accepts Pershing Gulf veterans' blood Do you know anything about this, or have you had that experience with that?
Yeah. Even while I was still in the service, after I came back, I was still active for 6 months. And they wouldn't take our blood anymore, even the military. And since I've been here, back in the Bay Area where I work, they have a United Way blood drive every year. And, you know, that's a question that they ask.
Well, this makes many of us suspicious that they won't accept your blood.
Yeah.
But on some other things, you know, there's been much hip-hop array about so-called heroes like Colin Powell and Schwarzkopf and Bush. What's your view of Schwarzkopf in light of the things that have transpired?
Well, I think they're little men. They're making a lot of money, or at least Schwarzkopf is, on writing a book, wrote a couple books, I think, and cashed in big on it. But I've yet to hear him really make a serious comment on the veterans that supposedly he felt for and loved so much and, you know, wanted to look out for. And he doesn't say anything. I'm sure he knows what's going on. He's not deaf, and he could probably enlighten us all, but he chooses not to for whatever reason, but makes a lot of money, you know, doing his thing. And I think he's a little man.
I hope what the people of America will see over the next couple of days, as Lieutenant Baker and his deceased colleagues are recognized, is a man who represents many, many men. Is a man who represents many, many men. Is a man who represents many, many men.
How do you feel about your active service in the military now?
I'm a little disillusioned. Like I said, when I went in, you know, I was doing it for all the patriotic reasons and stuff. And now I feel stupid, because I feel like, you know, I was used. And the understanding that I had was that I do 4 years with them, and they take care of me for 4 years, but they haven't fulfilled their end of the bargain, and I think I'm more than fulfilled my end.
Who served a country that was not serving them, but nevertheless served. And I hope it will give inspiration to new generations of youngsters coming up, black and white, of what valor and service to country mean. And white. Black and white. Of what valor and service to country mean.
Well, how do you feel about U.S. policies towards Iraq, or U.S. policies in general towards the Third World? Because it all seems to kind of tie together.
Well, there's no doubt Saddam's crazy. But the people of Iraq, you know, they're probably just like you and me. I'm sure they are, you know, trying to put food on the table and stuff. And, you know, I know since the end of the war, there's been about 45,000 babies have died in Iraq. More than usual because of the sanctions we have. So it kind of makes me feel ashamed that we just kind of forgetting about these people, you know. Although, you know, Saddam is a nut, and I think he is and all that, but, you know, the regular people, they're the ones that suffer.
It seems like Sam's a nut too.
Yeah. Yep.
And I hope what the people of America will see over the next couple of days, as Lieutenant Baker and his deceased colleagues are recognized, is a man who represents many, many men, who served with quiet dignity, who served a country that was not serving them, but nevertheless served. And I hope it will give inspiration to new generations of youngsters coming up, black and white, of what valor and service to country mean. Generations of youngsters coming up, black and white. New generations of youngsters coming up, black and white. 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 Of what valor and service to country mean. Of what valor and service to country mean. Valor and service to country mean. What valor and service to country mean. Of what valor and service to country mean. Of what valor and service to country mean.
Thank you.
white America's greatest generation. Your greatest generation, you tell us, is unlike any other in the history of the world. A generation spent on saving Private Ryan. A generation that saved democracy and the free world for a Christian father knows best families. A greatest generation with principles and traditional American values of justice that are peerless. But it was your greatest generation that would beat my black grandmother to a bloody pulp if she didn't get in the back of the bus. They would lynch our brothers because your own sexually reckless eyeballing insecurity and madness. Your greatest generation made postcards of the little black kids you lynched, with your kids often posed with you in those postcard lynch pictures, all in the family. Your greatest generation would break up my uncle's charred bones and body parts and sell it at your dime stores. Your greatest generation of wives would spit on my aunt as she tried to integrate into your schools, while your greatest generation of policeman husband would sick dogs on my cousin as he walked down your Jim Crow paved sidewalks. I see loads of Japanese American being herded off to your Asian concentration camps. You tell my sister she can't drink from that water fountain, but it's your lips that have contaminated the earth. What a great white generation you have with your white Klan robes, your white hot burning crosses, backed by a white worldview of white supremacy and purity. You had the same views as your white brother in Germany, Adolf, which may be why your greatest generation voted him Man of the Year in your great Time magazine. Your greatest generation would advise your kids not to listen to our coon music while your King of Thieves, Elvis, minstreled it out for you in a whitewashed, contaminated form. So while your greatest generation were dancing their twisted black man in white Elvis skin fantasies away, your greatest generation was dropping atomic bombs on Japan. Now that was original. Genocide by sundown. That's your greatest generation. So for a while, white psychotic greatest generation does not hold a candle to any black generation that has ever existed on this continent. You John Wayne stolen Lone Rangers cartoon land march around as if one is king of the earth. For your greatest generation has been like all before and after, a baptized generation of thieves, cowards, hypocrites, racists, and rapists. A greatest generation with the moral values and integrity of Jeffrey Dahmer, Charles Manson, and the John Birch Society all rolled up into one ball of Southern strategy, supremacist violence, based in lies, denial, and barbaric corruption passed on from one generation of flag-waving bigots to another. There is no difference from a lynch rope greatest generation to a Rampart Police, Rodney King, Abner, New York Police, rape, sodomized Louima generation. The slave ships you sailed over to Africa, you now sail to Iraq, back to Cuba and Haiti. Your greatest generation is as much of a fraud as your hero John Wayne, a draft dodging racist whose heroism was as scripted and phony as the American home of the free myth.
and that home of the free myth is as shallow as your great white hope generation. What we have here is a clear snapshot picture of a society so decadent that it pathetically has to hold up a raggedy generation of lynch mob, Jim Crow, apartheid-sustaining deviants that toss so many black souls in its American flesh-burning ovens that the scent is still floating in the air. So please, if that's your greatest generation, past and present, then your people really don't have a future. At least not on this earth.
Right. Everything I knew was wrong.
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system. But they have no perception and no way to measure what the amount of energy that's going to flow out from that light on is going to do to the rest of the planets and the solar system.
All right, you know what time it is now. Beyond the Shadow. And tonight, what I think we're going to start off with is how some of this mythology in this world is spread, or at least in particular, this particular country. From this greatest generation myth to events that have recently happened around 9-1-1 to an event that happened in 1999, there's a similar strain in how these particular events, in a way, this particular society goes into a form of denial about how these things could happen, what are the reasons for them happening, and those who have been somewhat complicit in them happening. In April of 1999, in Denver, two names have become infamous: Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, both teenagers who decided to take whatever was warped inside of them out on their classmates at Columbine High School. We're going to explore that a little bit, because there are certain ways, there's similarities in how new evidence and past evidence about that particular incident have been denied, suppressed, which is part of an American trademark when you have a society that's really in denial about itself. So first, let's hear a recent show that has covered some of the issues that have popped up about Dylan and Eric. And start off with how they were themselves, before they engaged on their April 20th, 1999 massacre / suicide pact, they had basically worked it out in their own
script and video production. This is what I mean. Check this out.
No, you piece of pinhead! Do not even school that little kid!
Early December 1998, another video production, which they call Hitmen for Hire. The two cast themselves as trench coat mafia Avengers, paid by school nerds to kill Josh.
Look, I don't care what you say. If you ever touch him again, I will freaking kill you.
Violent fantasies of revenge, payback for being bullied in real life at the hands of high school athletes.
I'm gonna pull out a goddamn shotgun and blow your damn head off.
By now, a date has been picked to turn their fantasies to reality. Registering his AOL profile, Harris fills in under hobbies, preparing for the big April 20. You'll all be sorry that day.
Do you understand, you little worthless piece of crap?
Soon, fake guns will give way to real ones. The massacre is now 5 months away. December 1998, Harris and Klebold go to a Denver gun show and buy three long guns, two shotguns, and a rifle. Since they're underage, only 17, the purchase is actually made by Robin Anderson, a friend, a fellow classmate who had just turned 18 the previous month.
We weren't really, you know, emotional confidant friends. You know, we hung out on the weekends.
Anderson asks Harris and Klebold, "You aren't going to kill anyone?" They answer, "No." 5 months to the massacre. January 23rd, 1999. The two buy a fourth gun, a semi-automatic pistol, from a 22-year-old friend of a friend. They pay $500 in two installments. The bridge separating fantasy from reality is being crossed. The massacre is just 3 months away. They start training, actually videotaping one session with a school camera. Disturbing images of the gunmen and the guns they'll use in Columbine.
Try to hit the tree. I want to see what a slug does to the tree.
They go on to wonder what damage such ammunition would do to a human being. Eric and Dylan have already illegally sawed off the shotgun.
Guns are bad. When you saw them off and make them illegal, bad things happen to you.
Here with them is Mark Mani, who sold them the semi-automatic pistol. All their peers would later say they had no idea what the two were planning. But shouldn't have someone figured it out? Remember, during most of this period, Eric and Dylan meet often with a probation officer as punishment for breaking into that van. He detects nothing, calling Eric a really nice young man who seems responsible and remorseful. In fact, the officer is so impressed, Eric and Dylan are rewarded early release from the probation program, which is rare, 2.5 months before the massacre. And what did they know at the school? There were a number of disciplinary incidents involving the killers. That February, Dylan hands in a school writing essay describing in gory detail a man of exactly his height, 6'4", dressed in a long black coat like his, executing preppies who had offended him.
Well, what up, dog? I heard you got some beef with me.
At the bottom, the teacher writes, "You are an excellent writer-storyteller, but I have some problems with this one." The teacher calls Dylan's parents. She says they don't seem worried.
Now, one must ask, what the hell is going on here? You know, Harris and Klebold had made two videos where they, school videos, where they did some kind of acting where basically they went through killing preppies and jocks at the school. And in many ways, it's like a bad imitation of the movie Heathers. If I was ever to write a movie on Klebold and Harris, I would integrate that movie Heathers into it. Because you remember in the movie Heathers that starred Christian Slater, he was like some outsider that moved in from another town. He always wore this long trench coat. And he hated the in crowd and the jocks. And he goes on a mission to kill
the most popular jocks and preppies in the school. Now, he makes it look like they, you know, committed murder themselves, did suicide, you know, committed suicide on themselves, so on and so forth. But he goes into these various elaborate plots. And the whole thing is set up, you know, where he's like this kind of outside rebel. And when you see these videos of Klebold and Harris walking through with their little trench coats, like Christian Slater in the movie Heathers, and basically going after the same type of individuals, like I said, their whole little stunt looked like a bad imitation. And the fact that they were running around with a website talking about these types of planned episodes made a couple of videos at school. And then you heard also wrote, you know, for some little thing to be turned into the teacher, this type of trench coat vigilantism. One must ask, how did not these signs of distress become more apparent to all of these individuals whose lives they weaved in and out of? I mean, one must be looking at the world through a seriously tinted lens, because there's no way that two black males could have talked about killing their classmates, make videotapes of themselves doing an enactment of them killing their classmates, have websites talking about killing their classmates, write term papers talking about killing their classmates, dress in a kind of way that is reminiscent of a popular, almost cult status movie that the main character was involved in killing his classmates, not the warning signs come up. I mean, this is what I mean by being in denial and just rewriting history and looking through such tinted lenses at the world, that when those right in front of your face are basically screaming for help, you can't see it, because that's not the image that you have embedded in your mind doing those types of behaviors. But next, as the countdown gets closer to its tragic ending, it becomes more apparent for those who at least truly want to see it. So let's explore it and take it from there. Check this out.
Here he is in recently released video in the Columbine cafeteria. By now, he has finalized his plan. It centers around blowing up this very room. April 5th. Eric appears to be planning for his future, meeting with a Marines recruiter. 10 days later, Eric's mother asks the recruiter if someone on antidepressants can join. The Marine says he'll call back. He never gets a chance. The massacre is less than a week away. On the last Saturday of his life, April 17th, Dylan Klebold takes Robin Anderson, who bought three of the guns, to the Columbine prom. Eric does not attend. Robin drops Dylan back home at 3:45 the following morning. Just before dawn, Dylan writes in his notebook, "About 26 and a half hours from now, the judgment will begin. Difficult, but not impossible. Necessary, nerve-wracking, and fun. What fun is life without a little death?" The following evening, Eric meets up with Mark Manas, who sold the killers the semi-automatic pistol. He tells Manas he and Dylan are going shooting the next day. At 5:30 a.m. on April 20th, Dylan's parents hear him leave the house. Soon after, in Eric's bedroom, the boys record their last piece of video, which will be discovered only after their suicide and is still sealed from public viewing. On camera, Dylan says, "Hey, Mom, gotta go. It's about a half an hour before our little judgment day. I didn't like life too much, and I know I'll be happier wherever I go. so I'm gone. Around 8 a.m., they shop for last-minute supplies. Eric Harris is seen in these blurry images from the store camera. 3 hours to go.
So once again, you have a situation where it's clear these guys are sick and need help. But it wasn't like they were doing something so covertly. They weren't any more covert than the so-called skyjackers on 911. And this is in part what I mean. If you look at how these issues develop and how transparent they are for those who want to see them while they're taking place and after they take place, then you can actually deal with reality. But in this type of society, especially in its present state, and actually there's a history to this, where much of the fabric of American identity has to do with not looking at reality squarely, is looking at things through lenses that says certain things and certain images are a danger, and certain things are not. Certain things I need to look out for and concern myself with, and certain things I do not. Now, Klebo and Harris, for obviously with any community with its eyes halfway open, it was apparent, it was more than clear that they were on a suicide mission with intentions that were basically as apparent as the skyjacking events that were about to take place on 911. But once again, the denial factor takes place. So now let's go into how Klebo and Harris make their move on that day in April 20th, 1999. They've already shot two students outside the entrance. Let's see how they proceed from there, and then we'll take it from there. Check this out.
Started shooting at anything that moved.
Brian Rohrbaugh's son, Dan, exiting the school, is about to walk directly into the line of fire.
Dan had gone outside with a couple of friends. At some point, I think he realized something was wrong and ran to get away, and was shot in the leg and then shot twice from the front.
Witnesses hear the shooter say, "This is what we always wanted to do. This is awesome." By now, two are dead, six injured. 11:24, in the cafeteria, teacher Dave Sanders and the custodial staff hear the shooting right outside the large windows and yell at students to get down. Then Sanders directs many to the safest exit. Chaos follows. But art teacher Patty Nielsen, hall monitor at the time, thinks the student she sees shooting outside is just pulling a prank.
I started heading out there to tell them to stop. I was on hall duty, and I was just going to tell them to stop. And then he turned around and shot.
Injured from shattering window glass, Nielsen escapes to the library, one floor above the cafeteria. The shooters move into the building after trading fire with a sheriff's deputy assigned to the school. The deputy stays outside and calls for backup. By now, 911 is flooded with frantic calls from inside Columbine.
He's shooting everywhere. The guy's running around shooting like crazy. Oh, my big gun.
Well, we just got a frantic call from my daughter saying he's chasing us with a gun. And then she hung up the phone and you could hear the screaming in the hallway.
Yeah.
Teacher Dave Sanders, still directing students to safety, runs into the killers. He turns to escape, but they shoot and injure him. He's helped by a fellow teacher to a side room. Outside, students are running for safety into the arms of gathering law enforcement. Inside, crouched under the library's front desk, teacher Patty Nielsen calls 911 as shots get closer and closer.
I'm in the library. I've got students down under the table, Skip. Heads under the table.
So you thought, if we can just sit tight here, someone will come.
Yes, sir.
How quickly did you think somebody might be able to get there?
I expected the police were on their way.
We got help on the way, ma'am.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Stay in line. Oh, God. Stay on the
line. Is there any way you can lock the doors?
Smoke is coming in from out there. Okay. The gun is right outside the library door. Okay. 11:29 a.m., 10 minutes after the first shots are fired, the gunmen enter the school library.
Did you ever actually see them come in?
No. I heard them come in.
Did they enter the room with the same anger poured into all their make-believe video productions? Patty drops the phone, but it picks up everything. The killers order all jocks to stand up. There are 56 people in the library. No one stands up. One of the gunmen says, "Fine, I'll start shooting."
I heard a lot of things after that. A lot of hateful, horrible things after that.
They had trained for this sickness for months. Klebold and Harris go table by table, laughing, taunting, and shooting students cowering under the desk. Harris bends down under one table saying, "peekaboo," to two terrified girls before killing one and forcing the other to plead for her life.
And there's really nothing anyone can do at that point.
Now, once again, you have a situation where even after Dylan and Klebo start shooting, you have one hall monitor. This can't phantom. This is really happening. So she wanders out there and almost gets shot herself. Now, at this time, there were school shootings always happening in these types of environments. I'm not talking about some urban environment and all of that type of stuff that's usually played up. I'm talking in these rural and suburban type of settings. And as mentioned before, Klebo and Harris had made it clear that they were planning to do their little, psychotic vendetta against the world, or at least their classmates. But all of these people are completely caught off guard. And they're caught off guard because of how they look at danger. Then you have them trading shots with a deputy. And unlike, the myth that you see on TV, where, of course, if this had been a TV show, the mythological cop would have heroically, ran after them to save any students' lives he could, because he wouldn't have allowed them to go inside the building armed to the teeth. But this is the real world. He kept his ass outside and called for some help. So you just see one myth after another start to crumble right before your eyes. As next, the myth of the superhero cops scenario. Well, this reality brings it home about how these cops really act in these situations and some of the consequences. This is what I mean. Check this out.
Three additional deputies had arrived at the school before the shooting in the library had begun. Two more arrived during. But they're busy setting up roadblocks, helping fleeing students. Even when they hear continued gunfire coming from inside, none go into the building to chase down the gunmen. The shooting inside continues uninterrupted, table by table. Klebold approaches one table with three students huddled underneath and shoots a fellow senior, school valedictorian Lauren Townsend, her mother, Dawn Anna.
My child stayed in that library when she was near an entrance because she was told help was coming.
Killer Eric Harris approaches as well and shoots her again.
She waited for help that never came. It's very hard to understand when I look at videotapes of how close they were outside of the building and that they didn't come in there. And I told them that they were killing kids in the library.
The killers leave the library at 11:36. They were in there only 7.5 minutes. 10 people are dead in the smoke-filled room, 12 more wounded. outside. Once again, like the previous year and the year before that, the Browns are calling authorities to point them to the source of danger.
We know who the kids are?
Okay.
So we're here about Eric Harris.
Eric Harris?
My son saw him.
What's your name?
Brooks Brown.
Okay.
I saw Eric.
Okay.
Right before the shooting.
Are you okay?
I'm like freaking out because he basically handed me my life on a platter. He told me, Brooks, I want you to leave.
Now, how do you go from talking to Eric Harris and him saying get out of here to thinking, I bet he's shooting people?
Because of the death threats, because of what was written on the web pages.
In a minute, he put together what eluded authorities for 2 years. And even now, outside the school, law enforcement was not moving in on Harris and Klebold. Paralyzed, according to later investigations, by confusion, lack of communications, and a concern there were hostages in the school.
I would like to know who was in command that day and who gave or did not give orders.
Inside the building, hundreds of trapped students hiding. The two killers roamed the halls uncontested, just as they had pretended in all their videos.
Well, there you go again. Now, you know, not only did they shoot it out with that one little cop, but as they said, five more cops arrived around 11:29. So that basically means within the first 10 minutes, because they started shooting at 11:19. So they had six cops. And unlike all of this myth, you know, that's often created in these movies and TV shows, these cops don't do nothing but just sit outside with their teeth chattering. The reason why I mention it is that the same way that you have the Greatest Generation myth going on, and in part because of those who participated, at least the right ones, that participated in World War II in America, the way they're mythologized is the same way that the cops in this society are mythologized as some kind of heroic figures and all of that type of stuff. So you heard the one woman talking about her daughter. The only reason why she stayed in the building was because she believed help was coming, even though she was very close to the exit. She skipped that myth stuff. Don't have faith in these raggedy-ass cops. Get out. Save yourself. Don't depend on these fools. They're not there to save you in the first place. And then you heard when he started talking about the family, the Browns started to call and say they were sure of it and all of that. The Browns were a family, our family, that had had run-ins with, you know, Dylan and Klebold and Harris. So they had done reports on these guys because of the threats they had made to, you know, their son and so on and so forth, and just them acting out. They had taken some of this stuff to the police. But, you know, the police just did their own little thing. And months to a year later, Harris and Klebold go on the attack, while the cops make excuses that they were paralyzed by confusion and a lack of communication and thinking that these guys had hostages. Mythologies. Next, let's go into how a victim who was shot up by Klebold and Harris, how they found themselves waiting for these mythical heroes that don't exist, and how from there the cover-up of went down ensued. And from there, we can start tying some of this stuff together, which is in part the point of this particular segment. Check this out.
You were on the ground for an hour and 20 minutes.
Was it that long?
Paralyzed for life. But there was still hope for one last victim, hovering between life and death, kept alive by students thinking help was nearby.
His name is Mr. Saunders. Okay. Okay, we're trying to get somebody there to him now, okay?
They just kept telling him, help is coming, hold on, help is coming, they're on their way. And 3 hours later, they were still hearing that.
The first SWAT team had entered the school at 12:06. about 45 minutes after the first shots were fired. But treating this as a hostage situation, not knowing the killers had already committed suicide, and fearing an ambush, they slowly inched towards Dave Sanders, reaching him more than 2.5 hours later. This, despite students indicating with that sign, one bleeding to death. Sanders will be pronounced dead shortly after.
It's been my statement, and it will be my statement for the rest of my life, that Eric and Dylan caused Dad's injuries. The lack of response by the police department is ultimately what killed him.
Angela Sanders sued Jefferson County and settled for $1.5 million. The county did not admit any wrongdoing. Grieving families say they had hoped more would be learned in the aftermath of Columbine. But they say critical clues to what happened were kept secret and others were being covered up.
I thought we were going to come together at this table and say, these are the warning signs that I saw. And I didn't recognize it then. But I see it now.
Nobody ever threw the pieces on the table.
Nobody is throwing the pieces on the table.
All right. Now, you see where I'm coming from now. When you hear, here we have another group of victims and or their family members talk about how critical evidence about the state's, the police's response has been held secret and covered up. What does this sound like? 911. It's the same game, same system, a same type of authoritarian process. And you have situations where, just like with the victim's family members in Columbine, being shocked and awed about how this government and its various representatives and police agencies have dragged their feet on the evidence and what evidence they did know and what information did they know about Klebo and Harris beforehand, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same thing you've seen go on with the victim family members who were in the planes and in the buildings on 9-1-1, 2001. You see the same type of thing continue where you see the state hold up evidence. They have these fake hearings and investigations. It's clear, especially to the victim's family members, that the whole thing's a cover-up and a fraud. Meanwhile, much of the American population, this kind of goes on in this mythological land and doesn't come close to analyzing and or even just basic basically using a basic form of observation about what's going on, and then has the illusion because some nuts get up there and say, we're going to carry this out as thorough as possible, and, you know, throws various heartwarming slogans about how we're all in this together. But most of the population goes to sleep. You see a continuation of this type of process. So you have all of these people who are the victim family members from 9-1-1 2001 being frustrated and calling Boy George to task for what they have and have not covered up and what they are doing as an institution to deny the truth from getting out. And this is what I mean. If you go to the 911 issue, you have Ellen M. Marini on a Thursday, November 27, 2003, she sent an open letter to Boy George. And she says this, Mr. Bush, this open letter is coming from my heart. I want you to know that I'm neither a Republican nor a Democrat, and that this is not an attempt to, quote, bash the government. You, Mr. Bush, should be held responsible and liable for any and all acts that were committed to aid in any cover-up of the tragic events of September 11, 2001. as president, you have duty to protect the American population, da, 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 so on and so forth. But she goes into how, continuing to quote, when you took no responsibility towards protecting the general public from the possibility of attack, you were certainly not withholding the oath you spoke when you took office. In that oath, you pledged to uphold the Constitution of the United States of America. While our nation was under attack, you did not appear to blink an eye or shed a tear. You continued on as if everything was, quote, business as usual. In the following days, the days following the attack, all air traffic was grounded, and Americans, including myself, were stranded wherever they had been when the flight ban was imposed. I was stranded at Midway Airport in Chicago, unable to continue on to California for my daughter's wedding. Imagine my surprise when I later found out that during this no-fly, quote-unquote, period, a number of people were flown out of the country on a 747 with Arabic lettering on the fuselage. None of these people were interviewed or questioned by any local, state, or federal agencies. Why were they allowed to leave, and who exactly was on the flight? She then goes on about some of her particular beliefs and talks about, quote, after 9/11, the Patriot Act and Homeland Security Act were passed. Both of these allowed the government to tap your telephone, search your home, and seize whatever they feel they need to do on a whim. They can do this without a judge's review or warrant. I feel that this is in direct conflict with our rights as stated in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. We, the families of 9/11 victims, need to have answers to the following questions. One, why were 29 pages of the 9/11 committee report personally censored at your request? Two, where are the black boxes from Flight 11 and Flight 175? Three, where are the voice recorders from Flight 11 and Flight 175? Four, why can't we gain access to the complete air traffic control records for Flight 11 and 175? Five, where are the airport surveillance tapes that show the passengers boarding the doomed flights? Six, when will complete passenger lists for all the flights be released? And seven, why did your brother Jeb, the governor of Florida, go to the offices of Hoffman Aviation School and order the flight records and files be removed? These files were then put on a C-130 government cargo plane and flown out of the country. Where were they taken, and who ordered it done? So here you have a situation where you see the 9/11 victims seeing that their basic rights to find out basic facts have been sabotaged by these institutions within this market system. And as you're starting to hear with the Klebo and Harris, you see cover up and corruption once again. Most of the population is not in tune with this because they believe in this myth of a law and order, as these silly TV shows are called, justice system. It's a fraud. Now next, let's go into the grieving families who expressed their frustration from the years of secrecy and cover-up post-Columbine. Check this out.
Perhaps they could reconcile with the 2 years of missed clues before Columbine, even the hours of hesitation during Columbine. But it's hard to come to terms with what appear to be 5 years of secrecy since Columbine.
I thought the parents of the murderers were going to come forward. I thought the school district was going to come forward. I thought the police department, JEFCO, was going to come forward. I waited and waited and waited.
Grieving families, including Dawn Anna, say the loss of their loved ones demanded the tragedy be understood to keep it from ever happening again. The killer's parents apologized a year after the massacre, though to this day they declined to talk publicly about it. Right after the shootings, the sheriff, John Stone, vowed justice.
If it takes us 5 years to get to the bottom of this, we're going to dig and dig and dig until we get every element of this crime solved.
But over the next 5 years, some parents began suspecting those closest to the killers and law enforcement were covering up what they knew before and after the shooting. So the families filed more than a dozen lawsuits against the killer's parents, the school, and the sheriff's department to get answers.
I'm still waiting for someone to step forward, and I haven't seen it.
We needed to understand
What happened to our children? What led up to it? Could it have been prevented?
Brian Rohrbaugh, who lost his son Dan that fateful day, says the sheriff's department insisted again and again that nothing could have been done because no one raised red flags before the shooting. And when Randy and Judy Brown insisted publicly that they had, authorities dismissed their contact with the Browns as minimal, insignificant. But in information released as recently as 2 months ago, the families learned the sheriff's department had not one or two, but 15 contacts involving either Harris or Klebold before Columbine. Though some were minor, 11 involved the Browns.
At some point, you have to say, what does it take before you pay attention to this?
By mid-March 1998, authorities should have had enough information from the Browns to possibly send Harris to juvenile prison for the van break-in. If they had, that could have derailed the massacre. But it appears no one considered the pipe bombs and the web threats when granting Harris probation. Rohrbaugh also points out that in the probation application itself, Harris tells authorities he is angry, depressed, and a huge red flag, has homicidal thoughts. He was thinking about killing people 13 months before he actually did. But perhaps the most stunning revelation, remember when the Browns met with deputies at headquarters, pleading with them to do something a year before the massacre?
How quickly did you think they were going to take action?
Immediately.
Immediately.
What the Browns didn't know was that investigators and bomb experts thought the combination of the violent web pages and the perfectly described pipe bombs was so serious, they drafted a search warrant for the Harris house. A search warrant that a supervisor dismissed.
We never knew that. We would have gone further. We would have done anything.
We now know the supervisor said he didn't think there was enough evidence to go into Eric's house. We discussed this decision with Colorado's Attorney General, Ken Salazar.
Was there enough evidence there for a judge to go ahead and issue a search warrant?
Having reviewed the affidavit, I think there was enough evidence in the affidavit to move forward.
Had they ever gotten that search warrant?
They would have found the pipe bombs that he'd been building for 10 or 12 months. They would have found weapons, knives, violent writings. Eric would have gone to jail and Columbine never would have happened.
No doubt in your mind.
Not a doubt in our mind.
Even more frustrating to the Browns, they say, the warrant listed the pipe bomb and webpage. But surprisingly, it failed to mention that Harris had a criminal record and was on probation. Also bewildering, no one tells any of this to Harris's probation officer. Once again, Harris slips through the system even as he was planning Columbine.
Now, once again, what does this sound like? This sounds like a bad script of 911. First, the cops say that there was nothing that could have been done to prevent it. No red flags. That sounds like Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice. No smoking gun. Even though the guns are waving with the smoke coming out of it right in front of their faces. But this is all just a scam. Then the sheriff department had 15 contacts and been told about 15 incidents at least with the whole, Eric Harris and stuff. 11 from the Brown family that had had continuous run-in. Now, I'm not talking about the cops being any kind of savior or anything. My point is to point out is that they're not to be believed in and trusted. To have your faith in those clowns. Look, if Eric Harris and them had a violent website talking about the state, talking about police corruption, talking about the decadence of this society, if they had had a website like a Raise the Fist website or some kind of anti-capitalistic overthrow style website, then they would have been knocking on the door the first few minutes. See, they don't care if some little, Campbell's soup knuckleheads have guns pointed at one another within this society. It's just a mythology that they have all of this concern and they're here to save the day and all of that. They're here to protect themselves. There's way too many facts on the ground and too many warning signs, and too many families, like the Brown family, coming to them, warning them about, warning the police directly about the danger of Eric Harris and what he is heading for. And then you have him himself talking to, you know, his little therapist type guy about he's having homicidal thoughts. I mean, how obvious does this have to be? It's just that the basic common working people's lives are not prioritized. And once something implodes within society, then they come with these fake solutions, almost Orwellian type of speak. You know, so if you think back, what happened when this episode happened at Columbine? All they did was run out with all of this gun control nonsense. Debates about gun control, passing new gun control legislation. Feinstein with her raggedy self started running out. And all of that's supposed to be, you know, some kind of solution. It's not a solution in anything. It's an illusion. I mean, think about it seriously. What is gun control? I mean, what has happened in this society? People have started to accept these authority figures' terms as if they actually mean what they say. The reality is that while it's easy to get guns on the streets of Oakland, easy, it's even easier to get drugs on the streets of Oakland and all throughout this country for that matter. Even though there's more stricter drug control laws than there are gun control laws. With certain types of guns, and if you're a certain age and have a certain type of record that's clean and all of that, you can buy certain types of guns legally. But you can't legally buy like heroin or cocaine, yet heroin and cocaine is so abundant and all over the place that it's easier to be involved in the drug trade than it is the gun trade. So to believe that just because they say they're using the term gun control, that that's somehow going to evaporate guns in some kind of mythological Orwellian speak is basically falling for their trick. Because what it does allow them to do is then, in the name of fighting guns, is to have their traditional wars. And we've seen how they've worked out. A war on drugs is basically meant war on black. A war on crime is meant war on black. A war on poverty means war on black. A war on illegal immigration means a war on Spanish-speaking blacks. A war on terrorism means, well, newly Negrified Arabs who are now under this classification might as well be black. And a war on guns is meant Amadou Diallo. Who killed Amadou Diallo? Some war on guns cops created by Ghoul of Inyani in New York. You know, Giuliani starts this war on guns crusade, and he has a segment of his department who's assigned to this. And they go from getting guns off the streets into this kind of third world Colombian death squad regime that model is we own the night. So from getting guns off the streets, their terminology and phrase in the community that they say to people is we own the night, which basically means niggas, if we see you at night, we'll kill you. And then you have 19-year-old Amadou Diallo trying to enter into his house. And that night, you have these four Gestapo cops all pumped up with their war on guns mechanism backed by the state, fire 41 bullets at him, hitting him 19 times. They say, well, they thought his wallet looked like a gun, or was it his keys that looked like a gun? Oh, wait, wallet, keys, well, never mind. This is a nigga anyway. And the mission is complete. War on black. That's how the game is played out. Look, when Geronimo Gijaja got out of prison after much effort, after spending 27 years, former Black Panther, was framed up by the LAPD, FBI, and their COINTEL program while he was in L.A., et cetera, et cetera. It came out that one of the main persons who helped frame Geronimo was the notorious Julius Butler. Now, Julius Butler was an informant for the police and the FBI. And it came out that Julius Butler had a long criminal record himself and had felonies, which under California law forbade him from owning a handgun. But Julius Butler wanted a handgun for his own personal protection. So who did he turn to? The police and FBI, who not only allowed him to have a gun, but gave him the money to buy one. That's the whole point. So here's someone under their own law is not supposed to have a handgun. Not only do they knowingly allow him to have a gun, handgun, Julius Butler, but they give him the money to buy one. Because at the end of the day, it comes down to whose side are you on? Are you on the side of the states or not? It has nothing to do with safety or anything like that. In the same way that having illusions that the police are there for our safety, you know, whether you're worrying about Claiborne Harris or these raggedy politicians and FBI people who are there for your safety pre or post 9-1-1, that's just an illusion. What side are you on? When Jews in Nazi Germany were getting obliterated, the Nazis had a gun control act that they had passed in the 30s. It didn't have anything to do with whether you were a quote-unquote criminal on the street. It had everything to do with whose side were you on. If you were a brown cert, you can have a gun, and it was justified to the state. If you weren't, you couldn't have a gun. It didn't mean that you didn't have a gun. It meant that now they would use the power of the state because of laws passed to attack your region and your community. That's in essence what these control laws mean. These gun control, drug control, illegal immigration control laws, they know they're not going to stop the flow of drugs, guns, et cetera, et cetera. But now they can have the authority of the state using its law to justify their overall onslaught over the masses of the population. Now, next, as we get ready to wrap this up, let's go into the next phase of the so-called investigation of the Columbine Massacre by the Colorado Sheriff's Office. So check this out.
Colorado's Attorney General is now investigating the Sheriff's Department's actions before and after April 20th.
What do you think it was in the days right after the shooting that the public was given the impression that there had been no contact between the shooters and the Sheriff's Office?
I think there was a lot of confusion about what had happened.
But the Attorney General is concerned by several things he's learned. First, some General Sheriff's Department records involving a deputy who worked on the Harris file cannot be located. Second, the file about Eric Harris generated as a result of the Browns' complaints vanished several days after the shooting, reappeared, and vanished again. It is still missing.
So you haven't been able to find this file yet?
We have not been able to find the file yet.
Do you now think there was a cover-up in the Jefferson Sheriff's Office about their knowledge of these shooters before the shooting?
They will have more to say on that, I think, when we reach the conclusion of our investigation.
Most of the top command who handled Columbine at the Sheriff's Department have since left. None faced indictment or any disciplinary action over the massacre. None have agreed to talk to us. There's a new sheriff in Jefferson County. The Columbine family say he brings a new sense of hope to their quest. Many of the lawsuits by grieving parents have been dismissed or settled. Some received monetary compensation, though no admission of wrongdoing. Several parents retreated from public eye, but others, like those you met tonight, insist the battle for answers is far from over. As key pieces of evidence, what the school, the killer's parents, and authorities knew before the shooting are still being kept from the public, missing or tied up by litigation, leaving them painfully out of reach.
I was told that Lauren's last words were, "Everything is going to be all right." And that's what I hold on to. Everything is going to be all right, but not until people with any sort of values, with any sort of honor themselves, have enough dignity to come forward and tell the truth.
So once again, there's the reality of this particular society. From 9-1-1 to the Columbine, you see the same things happen. The families of Columbine are being told the files can't be located. And then the post file on Klebo and Harris disappeared, reappeared, and disappeared again. And what the police knew beforehand and the information that they knew beforehand is being held back. This is the type of society it is. It's fake transparency. It's the illusion of greatness from one generation to another, when in reality it's steeped in mythology, deceit, and cover-up. Hold on a sec.
Doubts, the doubts of many others, people of goodwill, highly educated, literate, who've informed themselves on the matter, that indeed there is doubt. What would it cost us to set up a tribunal, even if it's as rudimentary as three well-informed officers, to go through these cases? Just as a political matter, why doesn't the president say to the Secretary of Defense, for goodness sake, get Erwin Chemerinsky and his kind off my back, set up tribunals? Why don't they do
right.
it?
There's two things here. First, you're right. Why not do it? It could be cheap. It could be quick and speedy. I think some of that is happening now. I think you've seen Department of Defense has announced that they are going to review people. They're saying it's not because of Geneva, but they're doing it for political reasons, because of diplomatic pressure and so on. I think the second thing is there's an important message to send about what terrorism is. And I think this is part of the bigger picture of why these kind of issues are important. We don't want to legitimize terrorism, right? You are legitimizing terrorism if you're going to say terrorists are the same thing as honorable warriors who are captured in the laws of war and receive Geneva Convention protections.
Do you know a terrorist? Not long ago, this would have seemed like a ridiculous question, but not anymore. The United States government is offering rewards of up to $25 million for information that prevents an international terrorist act against U.S. persons or property, or brings to justice persons who have committed one. To date, more than $8 million has been paid. Stop and think about it. Information about suspicious activities involving aircraft, about stolen explosives or biological materials, about letters or packages. It all could add up to preventing a terrorist act. Now do something about it. Call Rewards for Justice at 1-800-US-REWARDS. 1-800-US-REWARDS. Or email us at mail@rewardsforjustice.net. You may be eligible for a reward. Your call or email will remain confidential. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of State.
This is a program that was initiated. This is especially sort of compartmented, very deep sort of covert black operation that was initiated a few months after Afghanistan, essentially because once the major skirmishing in Afghan, once the Taliban folded, we were left with still a war on terror, and the Pentagon was getting all kinds of leads and information, and they would want to send a special forces team, let's say, you know, name a country, Yemen, Sudan, to go pick up somebody, and there would be all this normal sort of process that happens in the American government. The American ambassador would want to know what's going on. The local military guys would want to know what's going on. The local government would want to know what's going on. Rumsfeld found this very easy. All of this stuff is not the way he likes to operate. He's very much cutting through all the bureaucracy. So he simply set up a back channel operation. It was what they call a SAP, Special Access Program, a very highly classified program inside the Pentagon. And he recruited a bunch of Delta Force and SEALs and some CIA people and other services. I'm sure everybody was handpicked. Everybody in it was under an alias, under a cover. Probably, I can't imagine. Maybe foreign. I just don't know. And they didn't need visas. They had the SAP, the Special Access Program, had a budget. They were buying covert planes, and by that I mean planes that were not described as discovered as marked as American necessarily. Certainly not as a military plane. And all the apparatus you need to run a secret little war. And they would pick up people, and they had their own detention centers, and apparently they would get the first cut of Al-Qaeda or suspected terrorists, and really the ones that weren't so useful went to Guantanamo. Pretty interesting. So, and then this group has been operating. It's been going on for a year and a half, 2 years now, I guess. Close to it. And without any trouble, and last fall, because things were falling apart in Baghdad and Iraq pretty badly, much more than the public knew. We had the UN bombing, the Jordanian bombing, but also internally there was a lot of anxiety about what was going on with the insurgency. Nobody knew anything. We had no sources. And it was decided in August, September that it's time to really get inside the Iraqi prison population, although we all understand that the prison population in Iraq is a lot different than, let's say, in Guantanamo, because take your pick. General Antonio Taguba report, the one that was out, made so much noise a few weeks ago. Taguba said 60% of the people in prison were basically innocent. The International Red Cross says 90%. So you had a situation where you had a different pool. Nonetheless, this special team was brought in, and Rumsfeld and his deputy for intelligence request, a guy named Stephen Cambone, brought it into Baghdad over the objections of everybody in the community. I should say everybody, many people, obviously, because you don't take a very quiet, clandestine program and move it into a military situation, into a war, because it doesn't function that way. And you dilute its value. In any case, they went into the prison. Very, very tough orders were given. We're going to use coercion if we have to, and we're also going to use sexual blackmail. We're gonna get these Ba'athist Sunnis. Rumsfeld was calling it by that time last fall the dead enders. These are the Ba'athist Sunnis, supporters of Saddam, that we thought were the core of the insurgency that we could not find. So the goal was to go into the prison population, get these guys, if we have to blackmail them by putting them in a compromising sexual position, do it. We all have gone through the ritual. Terrifyingly, a taboo it is in Islamic society for men to appear naked before other men, really. And we were going to do that, threaten to take the photographs of them and distribute it in their neighborhood to their family, to their mothers and fathers and wives or whatever, totally embarrassing them. And I think the goal was to, A, try and get some people to tell us what they do, and B, try and convince some people to go leave the prison and go back into the Sunni community and spy. But whatever it was, it quickly got out of control. By late October, I've been told, the CIA had some people involved in this program. They pulled out. They pulled out all of their people involved in the interrogation process in Abu Ghraib. Their general counsel said, this is nuts. They pulled out, and the program went along out of control, basically, until it started getting in trouble early this year. Programs, these special access programs, these SAP programs, I have learned a great deal about them. They can only be set up with the Secretary of Defense's approval. And the Deputy Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chief, they're all involved in this, in the setting up this. So he certainly was there at the beginning. And I'm told, the people that talked to me, I'm told that whatever Cambone did was cleared with. That was, he wasn't able to make a move like this. The without getting it cleared with Rumsfeld. So Rumsfeld had nobody suggesting that Rumsfeld knew the kind of wackiness that was going on. That isn't the point. The point is that the core, or the soul of what happened was the decision that was made. The genesis of the problems was in a decision that was made at Rumsfeld's level to bring this very secret effective team into Baghdad. Not all of it, some remnants of it. And also, my understanding is some of the people in military intelligence at the time were read into the program, this program that had been restricted so carefully.
So from the Abu Ghraib to Columbine to 9/11 to the Oklahoma City bombing to Waco to the Mumia case, the lies and cover-ups, the denies, the game of deception by the state is what bonds all of those issues. It's up to us to make a change that's going to come. That is, if we truly want a future beyond their mythological greatest generations. Until the next time, Slave Revolt.
Gotta come now. Ooh, yes it is.